Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, they say that love makes the world go around. And in the second half of today's show, psychotherapists and husband and wife team, Linda and Charlie Bloom, return with their new book, Happily Ever After, and 39 other myths about love. But first, we're going to look at anxiety and depression today. Are they mental illnesses or simply habits that we can learn to change? And to answer that question, I'm very pleased to welcome back Dr. Joseph Luciani. He is the author of the internationally best-selling self-coaching series. He's a frequent lecturer, TV and radio guest, and author, and has brought his message of hope to millions, as you can imagine. He's a clinical psychologist and has been in general private practice since 1977. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Joseph Luciani, but we're going to refer to him as Dr. Joe today, right, Dr. Joe?
Much better. Thank you.
There you go. And the book that we're looking at today is called Self-Coaching, The Powerful Program to Beat Anxiety and Depression. It's a way for us to help take control of our life right now. And I'm guessing that, you know, when people hear that, is it mental illness or is it just a habit? There are some people out there who are going to go, what? So explain that to us, if you would.
Yeah, I realize it's rather heretical. But, you know, it was Mark Twain that said, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is like the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. I believe that mental illness is not only the wrong word, but I think it's a misleading word. And I think that we need to understand that, you know, with an illness, you know, you catch an illness, you contract it. It makes us a victim. And self-coaching is all about realizing that anxiety and depression, these are, and I know this, again, will make some people, you know, sit back and say, oops, are self-generated problems. Now, what I mean by that is that we either feed these problems or we learn to starve these problems. And I'm not saying that anxiety and depression aren't chemical events. They most certainly can be. Our chemistry gets changed by stress, by duress, by the feeding that takes place. So it is a mind-body problem, but I think how you orient yourself and how you approach it either puts you in the driver's seat or in the back seat. And I know with my patients for years, I've used my coaching to encourage them to take charge of their lives, to realize what they're doing specifically that feeds the depression or the anxiety. And it is a quite effective modality. And I think it's important for all of us to realize that, you know, passivity doesn't really work if you really want to understand what you can do to really come out on the other side of this fence called anxiety and depression.
Right. You say that the talent that you most prize or most value as a psychologist is your intuition, which Jung described as the ability to see just around the corner. And you talk in the book about how once you magnified your view of anxiety and depression, you began responding differently with your patients. Tell us a little about how you started responding differently when that connected with you.
Well, I was brought into the field of psychology through traditional means. I studied at the Jungian Institute in New York for a while, and I was a traditional psychologist, you know, traditional therapy, where you explore the depths of the unconscious. I'm not debunking any of the traditional modalities, but I was impatient. I was looking more for a direct path to work towards, you know, think of a cigarette smoker. We don't need to know why you took the first cigarette. We need to know what you're going to do to break the habit. Now, when I speak of habit, let's just backtrack 1 second. It all begins with insecurity. That's the base or the primal element in my whole theorizing. No one escapes insecurity. insecurity. We don't live in a perfect world. No one has perfect parents. So we grow up with challenges. And in order to compensate for these challenges of insecurity, the vulnerabilities of insecurity, we develop strategies of control. And that can be worrying, rumination, avoidance, perfectionism. So we develop strategies that help us to cope for our vulnerabilities. And it is these strategies themselves over time become reinforced, and they actually begin to form the basis for a later problem. So when I say feeding and starving, it really has to do with understanding the element of control and the element of insecurity that really is the fuel for why we get ourselves into a stressful place. And stress depletes. Over time, stress depletes chemistry, and we become compromised.
I was surprised when I was reading your book how much you talk about insecurity and how much you talk about control, and yet it made perfect sense as I was reading it throughout the book. One of the things you share in a, you have throughout the book, training suggestions, because this obviously is a self-coaching program. You talk about inner experience, outer experience. You talk about learning to get out of your head. And this, I think, is very, very difficult for some people. I've heard friends who suffer with depression. They say, I have all these thoughts coming at me, and they have absolutely no control over it. And, the brain is a unit all of its own. So how do people like that, when they feel that way, start to get out of their head?
Well, the key word you just mentioned is when they feel that way. In the book, I have a three-step program called self-talk. And the first step is very pivotal. It's separating facts from fiction. Patients often say to me, I feel I can't. Once you start realizing that just because you feel something doesn't mean that that's a fact, you can start to challenge it. So we need to challenge our perceptions of, for example, someone might come in and tell me that, they're just not okay. They just are someone who's never going to get ahead, and they're really wedded to a lot of self-defeating negativism. This is fuel for depression and or anxiety, and yet they keep feeding it because it's become habituated. It's become their pattern. You become identified. Just as patients and people become identified with depression or anxiety. Mm. I'm depressed or I'm anxious. From the very beginning, I try to help people realize you are not your depression. Your depression is an overlay. Like if you were to put a sidewalk over a seedling, that seedling can't come up. It tries to find a crack in the sidewalk. It's an overlay on your personality, on your healthy personality. So you are not your depression. It is an aspect of you that has now kind of eclipsed your healthy personality, but nevertheless, it's not who you are. So in order to begin to fight the good fight, one needs to have hope and encouragement, realistic encouragement, to help them understand that if you feed through control, if I could just backtrack 1 second, the reason control is so important is because we're trying not to feel vulnerable. So we go through all these hoops, we juggle all these different type of control strategies to not feel vulnerable, but it's effortful. It's not without price. So we're stressing ourselves by trying to just keep this juggle going, keep it going. And life itself becomes stressful because we're trying to avoid vulnerability by being in control, which is an unnatural state. The reason we do it is because we don't have self-trust, and that's the end game. The end game is you need to develop the self-trust and the belief in yourself to handle what's coming, not anticipated, but to handle it more spontaneously in the moment.
Yes, it makes perfect sense to me. You talk in the book, and this is 25 years in the making. I mean, you say in the book it took you 25 years to be able to write this book. So this is tried and true experience and working with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of patients over the years. And you have 7 principles of self-coached healing, and I wanted to look at a couple of those. One, you already mentioned, which is insecurity. It's, as I said, a big theme throughout the book. And you say that everyone has a legacy of insecurity. And number two is is thoughts precede feelings, anxieties, and depression. And then I wanted to just look at number three a little bit more. Principle number three is anxiety and depression are misguided attempts to control life. And you talk about how control is always an illusion in principle number four. So if somebody's in that state, how do they start working and recognizing the symptoms that they have these control issues? Because I found a lot, you know, you'll meet some people who say, oh, I'm a control freak, and they're proud of it. And then you'll meet others who are really controlling and don't even know it. So how does somebody, if they're in that position, begin to start recognizing and self-analyzing so that they can begin self-coaching?
Well, the most important thing is to recognize that if you really continue to trip yourself up with the thoughts that are self-defeating, the thoughts that are kind of feeding the insecurity, the more you try to pursue control rather than self-reliance, you're going to stay in the loop. What I try to tell to people right away is to realize that what's missing in the equation is that you don't have the self-trust, you don't have the self-reliance to be able to handle life spontaneously. The reason that we develop the anxieties and depressions that we do is because we're really trying to avoid exactly what happens with the stressful circumstances of our life. We're trying to avoid getting depressed or anxious by controlling life, which eventually wears us down, brings us to our knees, by developing self-trust. I call it reflexive thinking. If I'm going to a party and I'm standing outside the door and I'm saying, now, is my hair okay? And my shoes okay? Am I wearing the right clothes? And I'm putting myself through all of this. This is anticipatory thinking. It's leading to stress, leading to some anxiety, maybe social anxiety. Whereas the person with self-trust opens the door, walks in, and then reacts in that moment to what takes place. So they have the courageous attitude to realize that I don't have to brace and anticipate life. I have to learn to live it spontaneously. Now, in order to get there, of course, you have to build that self-confidence and you have to build that trust muscle. But, you know, that's what self-coaching is all about. That's why I developed the concept of therapy and coaching, because you have to motivate people. And I try to do that through my books. I try to make people realize that a hopeful attitude is essential. It is essential, especially with anxiety and depression. But, you know, people are reluctant to embrace it because some people might say, well, why does medication work? You know, it's a chemical event. And this is true, but this is the end result. You see, the end result of a stressful life of control is that we deplete our chemistry, so we create imbalances. And I am not against medication, and certainly with more moderate to severe depression and anxiety, its place is very important. So it's very important to realize that it's a mind-body problem, and what we can do to minimize or ultimately even get off of medication is to recognize what we do that sustains the depletion that's going on. You know, you think of it like a bucket with little holes in the bottom. Those valuable brain chemicals are being dripped out, drip, drip, drip. We have to plug up those holes. We have to stop that in us, which is really creating the depletion.
Okay. And we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, I want to talk about, you say that we're not born with insecurity, we learn it. So how do we unlearn it? And I also want to look at perfectionism. And I have to thank you for being here with us today, because I know you have a head cold after your trip to Paris. So thank you for sticking out with us here. We're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Dr. Joseph Luciani. His book is Self-Coaching, The Powerful Program to Beat Anxiety and Depression.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800 1-800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
All right, everybody in the car, let's go.
What are we going to do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing, too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Coming up Monday, May 23rd on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, theater correspondent for The New Yorker and biographer of her, The Making of Meryl Streep, Michael Shulman. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time on Seattle's Alternative Talk, 1150 AM at FM 98.9 HD Channel 3. Find more than 300 podcasts and topics from health and mental wellness to travel, adventure, business, and the environment at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. I'm talking with Dr. Joe, better known as Dr. Joseph Luciani. His book is Self-Coaching, the Powerful Program to Beat Anxiety and Depression. And we're looking today at, are anxiety and depression mental illnesses? Do they need to be treated chemically or are they habits? And Dr. Joe's explaining this to us as we go through. And one of the things that runs through the book consistently is insecurity, and that can lead to depression. You say we weren't born with that insecurity; we learned it, and we can unlearn it. What are some of the ways we can identify how and where we're feeling insecure, and how do we backtrack out of that?
Well, insecurity is a perception of vulnerability, and it's often tied into a more primitive experience or learning that took place. As I said earlier, none of us have perfect parents, have avoided illnesses. We've all had our challenges growing up. But what happens is that we tend to have these nodules that create stress points in our life. And the child, being more vulnerable than the adult, of course, will start to react to these insecurity stressors in a dramatic way that can now set the stage for altering the perception, say, from a more optimistic, healthy perception toward a more pessimistic or vulnerable perception. So insecurities really develop early on, and the personality is really pretty much molded quite a bit by these early experiences. Now, what happens as we grow is that the habits become more or less part of how we identify ourselves. So we become identified with such things as being optimist or pessimist, being someone who is, just energetic or lethargic. So we tend to identify with the patterns that we've set down. I call these the child reflex. And like a knee-jerk, there are certain reflexive things that we do just because we've always done them. So it's important to realize the truth between fact and fiction. When we start to have a reflex of fear in safe places, we need to question that. We need to realize that may very well be, in fact, a child reflex based on historical insecurity. So consciousness, awareness, becoming more insightful as to those things that we habitually just connect ourselves to without ever really scrutinizing. I'm working, for example, with a young lady who was, the way I could describe it in my own mind is I almost see her sitting in the back of a classroom with her hands folded, never raising her hand, very timid. she goes through life now as an adult with that exact same posture. She's afraid to raise her hand, make a stir, be noticed. So she carries this burden, the child reflex, with her, where she is afraid to be noticed. She really needs to recede. And it's very difficult for her because when it comes to confrontations or someone saying something to her that may be a little challenging, she really can't protect herself at this point because she doesn't have that self-trust. So we need to recognize that we drag with us in life these child reflexes that need to be replaced with self-trust. And ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, that's the end game. That's where we start to break the patterns, the habits. That's where we stop feeding. We're going to go on doing the same old, same old, same old forever unless we do something to stop it.
Right. And as you said earlier, you know, when we're living in that state of trying to control everything or living in the state of constant lack of self-trust and insecurity, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. So no wonder we get anxious and depressed. So I want to talk a little about perfectionism, because this is, I think, a big one for many people. And again, it has the same outcome. But you say perfectionism lies, it's not about striving for perfection. It's more about the avoidance of imperfection, which places us always again in that state of being on call, as you put it, trying to maintain control, never being allowed to mess up. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, perfectionism is one of the controlling strategies that is rather interesting, because it's almost the opposite of what we think. We tend to applaud perfectionists. You know, we tend to see them as, bigger than life people striving for the best and all that kind of stuff. My contention is that you're not trying to be perfect. You're trying not to screw up. You see, that's the control aspect. If I'm perfect, if I never make a mistake, and of course this is mythic, you can't be perfect, but nevertheless, the perfectionist is saying, if I'm perfect and I never mess up, then I don't ever have to feel insecure. I, therefore, will always be in control. So that's actually, perfectionism is kind of a quintessential way of explaining my theory on control. Because you could see that by trying to be perfect in a world where nature abhors perfection, you can see where the energy requirement is going to be quite draining. In order to sustain that, you're on duty all the time.
Right.
You need to, whether it's cleaning the closets or how your hair looks or avoiding germs, the perfectionist needs to really be on top of things all the time. And that's control. Control is very, very destructive because basically, as I mentioned, it is unnatural. It requires effort to sustain control in life. And over time, it's that effort that becomes stressful, that depletes our valuable chemicals, and that tilts the scale toward anxiety or depression. And it should be noted that anxiety and depression are on a continuum. With both anxiety and depression, we have very normal kinds of stressors that create moods or mild depression. As we progress towards the middle and the other extreme, of course, we get into severe clinical aspects. But depression and anxiety are part of life. The clinical aspects of anxiety and depression, where there is the profound disruption, are not part of life. They can become part of life only if we continue to slide down a slope that continues to really put us in a more vulnerable place, where we try even harder and harder on that treadmill of control, which eventually we just absolutely wear ourselves out. Then, of course, we unfortunately get what we deserve.
Right. And the thing I love about your work is you do not come with this one-size approach fits all. You recognize there are so many different personalities and situations, and even perfectionism you break down into three different categories: the star, the fanatic, and the one we talked about earlier, the control freak. Because I think sometimes people don't recognize themselves or those symptoms in themselves because they kind of look at that one generic format. I want to just quickly talk about, you say that when you talk to your patients about letting go and living reactively, they became confused. What do you mean when you say let go and live reactively?
Well, letting go is anathema to someone who wants to be in control. But the last thing they want to do is let go. They want to oversteer life. So learning to let go is learning to trust that I can handle. I say to people all the time, how many problems have you solved in your life? 100, 1,000, 10,000. And you're sitting here today. Somehow you've managed to get here. You're a survival machine. And you need to start trusting the fact that you don't have to oversteer life. You need to instinctively recognize that you have the wherewithal, that you have the mechanisms to protect yourself, and that sometimes it's really just a matter of getting out of your own way and letting your intuitive, instinctual self handle what has to be handled rather than to overthink it. The ruminative, worrisome, anticipatory part of us that just feels that we can't be safe unless we know it's coming before it comes around the corner, we have to challenge that. We can handle what comes around that corner spontaneously with self-trust. As I said, we're survival machines. You've handled 1,000 different problems and challenges in your life. What makes you think you won't handle the next one?
Right, love it. And you have all these exercises going through the book, and they're very simple for, you know, very simple exercises, or they might just be reflections. And it's really all about practice. It's about recognizing what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're doing it, and practicing it daily, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think life itself is an ongoing, unfolding experience that we can begin to use in our favor to really free ourselves from the entanglements of the past. I once had a training analyst who said that his definition of neurosis was the contamination of the past with the present. Well, in order to live in the present, you need to let go. And as they say in AA, let go, let God, and you can do that in a secular fashion. It doesn't have to be a deity. But let go and trust. Let go and let our lives just come forward with trust. And you know what? The more that you just step out of your way and let things happen, you'll surprise yourself. But you're not going to do it if you're mired in fear. And most controlling strategies are fear-based. So let go and let's call it let life.
Okay, good. Sounds good. And for those who like positive affirmations, you say you must add this one. It's just a habit.
I stress the word just. People come in with such misperceptions about almost as if they come in thinking I'm going to be shocked that they're as upset as they are or anxious as they are. I tell them it's just a habit. Now, I'm not trying to minimize their suffering. Trust me on that. I'm really not. But what I want them to realize is that, hey, stop treating this as if it's beyond your control, as if it's from another universe. This is something that you can do to take care of yourself. You don't have to be fearful that you're dealing with something that is beyond your control. It's just a habit. We feed habits. We starve habits. All habits are learned. All habits can be broken.
I love it. Dr. Joe, thanks so much for being with us, especially with your head cold today.
well, thank you.
I appreciate you getting through this with us.
And I didn't sneeze once. Thank you.
And I want to let listeners know they can find out more about you at self-coaching.net. Self-coaching.net. And Dr. Joe has a ton of videos on the internet that you can listen to as well. And he's been with us twice, so we've got a couple of podcasts going up on the site. His book that we talked about today is Self-Coaching, The Powerful Program to Beat Anxiety and Depression. A final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Dr. Joe?
Well, the final quick thought is that your life is really in your hands. Get in the driver's seat, take control of it, and recognize that destiny is really how you live your life in the moment. So your future is in your hands right now. Live it spontaneously. It's the best way.
Thanks so much for being with us, and get better soon.
Thank you.
And my guest, Dr. Joseph Luciani, and again, his website, self-coaching.net. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by Linda and Charlie Bloom. I'm going to talk about some myths around love and relationships. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can.
Should have worn my glasses.
So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Tell your friends the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And in this segment, we're talking about Happily Ever After and 39 other myths about love. My guests are Linda Bloom and Charlie Bloom, both psychotherapists. They're best-selling authors and the founders and co-directors of Bloomwork. And you can find their website at bloomwork.com. They've lectured and taught seminars on relationships throughout the United States and the world. And they've been married since 1972. So we're going to say these guys definitely know what they're talking about here. Linda and Charlie Bloom, welcome to both of you.
Delighted to be with you today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I want to start off with pretty much how you start the book, with six little words that probably the biggest myth of all time, and they lived happily ever after. Why so much disappointment around that phrase?
Well, you know, Vicki, when you think about it, that phrase holds an awful lot of promise for people. And it's certainly wonderful to have a grand vision for what you can experience together. And, you know, we have found that there's a tremendous amount of the possibility of a truly, deeply connected, committed partnership are greater than we can even imagine. However, the phrase happily ever after, think about it for a minute, it really suggests that we are going to have perpetual, continual happiness forever. That's a lot to expect. I don't know too many, actually I don't know any couples who have never had a bad moment, a difficult moment. We wrote our second book, Secrets of Great Marriages. We interviewed quite a few people for that book, and these people have been together for an average of 31 years, and they have great relationships, but
every single one of them experienced some challenging times.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't really factor that into the equation, you're setting yourself and your partner up for some real disappointment.
Yeah. And I think the big question around people who've been together forever, I mean, I have a brother and sister who've been married to their partners for 30 plus years in both cases. And sure, they've definitely had ups and downs. But what is it that makes some people just call it quits and walk away? And what is it that keeps some people together and make them work through it? I think that's the big question when you hear if somebody's been married a long time.
It's a huge question, and we definitely believe that not all marriages should be saved. There really and truly are some mismatched couples. But what we see is couples that are getting divorced, and they aren't necessarily mismatched. They maybe believe that there aren't any alternatives to what they're doing, but they've gotten into some destructive patterns. They may not be able to negotiate for their needs very well. They may have gone off to their own corners, you know, and avoided leaning into the challenge of the issues. Maybe their communication and conflict management skills aren't really high. So I feel like it's sad and rather unfortunate that most of the people who get divorced don't even go to one marriage counseling session. Mm-hmm. But sometimes if you consult a professional or a clergyman or the wise elder in your family or somebody that you feel has a really good relationship, they can help you to see how you may be getting in the way of really evolving to the point where you can have a good relationship, because so much of this is work on ourselves. It's to strengthen our commitment muscles. It's to develop our loyalty. It's to enhance our patience and our forgiveness and our courage to face the difficult issues. And so many people just think they're supposed to find the right person, and then it's supposed to happen out of that caring that you have for each other. And they underestimate the skill level and that we need to develop as individuals to be eligible for a great relationship.
Right.
So I think that having the personal growth orientation gives people a huge advantage to be able to make it to the good and delightful relationship realm.
Right. So I want to talk about fighting. So let's look at myth 16, because, you know, obviously this is why many couples split, because they say they fight all the time. But I've heard constantly that it's not, you know, that you fight. It's how you fight. The myth you have in the book is nothing good can come from conflict. You say there's a difference between fighting and conscious combat. I wonder if you'd talk to us about that.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing up that distinction, because I think it's really important. And we refer to conscious combat as a way of dealing with differences that is more responsible and actually more effective than fighting. Usually when we're fighting, each person has got their own agenda and their own objective that they want to fulfill, and they're often in conflict with each other. So there's very little possibility when two people are looking to win or to defeat the other person's position in some way, there's very little possibility that anything really productive can come from that. And as a result, people who don't learn how to engage in conflict in a more conscious way tend to either get stuck in patterns of arguing and oppositional patterns where they're opposed to each other that really don't go anywhere and are very painful and very destructive in the relationship, or else they become avoidant and they just choose to withdraw from the differences and not to deal with them at all, which turns out to be even more of a threat to a relationship than fighting badly.
Right, right. Linda, I know you had an issue with this. You write in the book about it. Myth 17 is that true lovers feel love for each other all the time. And you talk about when your kids were were very small, and you played out one scenario again and again between Charlie and yourself. Share that with us and how you solved that, if you would.
You know, this one was a myth that I was caught in for years. I was such a romantic, and I really felt that if you love somebody, it should just be constant. It should just be constantly flowing. And I was frightened by the fact that Charlie sometimes wouldn't be feeling his love for me. He sometimes would be preoccupied or overtired or stressed out or just need some solitude. He's introverted, and when he's stressed, he really needs to have some solitude, and I would take it so personally. And so the little vignette in the story, which illustrates it, is a crucial conversation that we had that was a major turning point, where I was crying and distressed because he wasn't feeling the love and expressing the love to me at a time when I was really wanting it. And we had a frank discussion, and he said, "It's down there. It's just buried under some things, and I can't always access it."
Right.
It was more important to me that we were honest with each other, that we wouldn't fake it. And so it was important for me that he told me the truth, but it was also important that bottom line, down there deep, the love was there. But sometimes he would be, you know, irritated with me or preoccupied with other things and just couldn't tap into it. Mm. And so that was a major turning point where I could allow space for us not to be either one of us. It freed me up too to not be connected to the love at all times.
Right.
And that's so much more realistic.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we've got lots of myths to cover here, so we're going to take a very quick break. My guests are Linda and Charlie Bloom. They're both psychotherapists and authors, and their new book is called Happily Ever After and 39 Other Myths About Love. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Fight, or so they say, but with love things never seem to work that way. With love you can't win, if love can't get in, and it can't pierce the heart of a defender. To win in love you must surrender.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org, but you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can.
Should have worn my glasses.
So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. email Vicki@VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Don't touch that dial. You might miss something life-changing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Receiver as well as sender. To win in love, you must surrender.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And in this segment, we're talking with psychotherapists Linda Bloom and Charlie Bloom, husband and wife team since the 1970s. They also author books together and speak around the world together. And this new book has been out for about 3 weeks. It's called Happily Ever After and 39 Other Myths About Love. So we're doing some myth busting today. And this is one that I hear all the time from friends who are breaking up with boyfriends or going through a divorce. And that is that I need to find a new love quickly because love will heal my pain. So who wants to fire off with that one?
I'm happy to speak about it because it is such a setup for trouble to put that much responsibility on somebody else. And I believe in the power of love, and I believe in the power of love to heal, whether it's family of origin pain, if we had difficulties in our childhood, that this can be a corrective experience to have a good, healthy relationship in adulthood. If we've had adult relationships that trust has been violated and there have been disappointments and betrayals and so forth, a new, healthy relationship can definitely help us to open and to have trust again. But do you know, to lay a trip on another person, and I really believe in having high expectations and going for the gold, but I also think that we have to have a high level of responsibility and intentionally and take responsibility for healing ourselves from our past wounds in childhood or adulthood. And not be looking to the other person to make our life okay and
right.
to make our life good.
Right.
They can assist. They can be supportive. They can listen. But they can't erase all of that pain and take it all away.
Right, right. We have to take personal responsibility for ourselves in whatever we do. And I just think there's such a lack of that today because everybody's looking for the quick fix around certain things. Go to any checkout stand and you'll see women's magazines with headlines, how to stop your man straying, how to keep your man happy and at home, etc., etc. So, Charlie, I'm going to ask you this. Myth number 29 is love and good sex make marriage a fair proof. Love and good sex makes a marriage a fair proof. Not true.
No, it seems like it should be, though, doesn't it?
It does seem like it, but...
Yeah, I mean, you'd think, but turns out a lot of the research that's been done regarding affairs confirms that the idea that it's not necessarily the sex that is the dominant motivator in straying into another relationship. It's very often... You can have good sex in a marriage or in a relationship, and there's still a vulnerability to getting involved with somebody else. That doesn't mean that, you know, you shouldn't want to have that. You shouldn't cultivate that, of course. But it doesn't guarantee it. One of the things that they have found is that researchers have discovered is that one of the experiences that people are looking for when they do go outside of the marriage for sexual experiences, is they're looking for novelty. They're looking for something different. They're looking for some experience that's going to take them out of the same old, same old. So you can have a very close connection with your partner. You can enjoy good sex with each other, but there may be something in the relationship or in your life that feels flat, that feels like it's not fully, you're not fully engaged in some way, that it's more of the familiar. And, you know, the familiar is nice. It feels comfortable. It feels safe. But any relationship, in order for it to be vibrant and vital, requires something more than safety. It requires some excitement, some enthusiasm, something different, something less predictable. We want to keep ourselves more fully alive and more fully engaged with life. And that's what one of the things that will make us into more attractive partners, sexually and otherwise, or our mate.
Right, right. And so when people are in long-term relationships, and Linda, I know this is something that you struggled with yourself. You write again about this in the book. You struggled with the fact that independence is strength and dependence is weak. That's how you saw things. So tell us what conclusion you came to.
Well, it's the prevailing cultural myth in this culture. There is a worship and an honoring of independence, and somehow dependence is made bad and wrong. It's needy, as if it's pathological. And we actually had the same belief in this myth, where Charlie was more self-contained system and more independent end of the spectrum. And so I was carrying the needs and the dependency for two people early in our relationship. And we colluded in that to make it somehow bad and wrong, my need for connection, my need for acknowledgement and validation. And it took actually years into the relationship for me to get past it and realize that every loving relationship has some healthy dependency in it, and that it's not codependent. There's nothing wrong with that. And when I could feel more centered in that truth, when I could shed the myth myself, then it set up a different dynamic where I wasn't embarrassed to ask Charlie for my needs. I didn't make myself bad and wrong that I was insecure, that I realized being courageous enough to tell the truth about what I needed in terms of connection. And I love a lot of connection, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just my style of being in the world. I'm a big, big connector, and I'm a relationship-oriented person, and that there's a beauty in that. And then I wouldn't buy in if Charlie was raising an eyebrow at me, you see, that I could stand grounded in that.
Right, right. Well, we're right at the end of our segments. I have one quick question left. And Charlie, this kind of continues from the last question that you answered about, you know, being your own, being a vital, interesting person. Myth 35 is that play is for kids. And I think this is one of the most important things in relationships. You have to play, right?
I'm totally with you in this one. Absolutely. There's so many of us who really think that there's a point in our lives at which we outgrow the need for play, and it ceases to be something that is an adjunct to the quality of our life, and it becomes something that we shouldn't engage in because we see it as being irresponsible and immature to need to play. We also, in this chapter in the book, we talk about play not so much as an activity, but as a state of mind. A way of being in which we give ourselves permission to really fully engage in the experience that we're involved in with an attitude of an attitude of lightness, to get pleasure and have fun in the experience. It's not limited to organized, structured games necessarily, but we can bring that attitude into anything that we do in our lives. Make it a game. Make it fun.
Yeah, I'm all for that. I am all for that. And I want to thank both of you for being with us today. It's a great book because it's so accessible. I love the fact that you've laid it out in myths, and you can just pick up and read very quickly one chapter at a time. A book is called Happily Ever After and 39 Other Myths About Love. Listeners can find out more about your work, I know, at bloomwork.com, bloomwork.com. And there's a ton of information up there about their services, books, and video clips up there. And they've also authored 101 Things I Wish I Knew When I Got Married. So, again, thank you so much, both of you, for being with us, Linda and Charlie Bloom. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having us. I enjoyed it.
And we thank you for joining us today. And again, Linda and Charlie Bloom, you can find out more about their work at bloomwork.com, bloomwork.com. If you have questions or feedback on today's show, you know where to find me, 800-495-7617. You can also email me at info@conversationslive.net. And you'll find us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.